Blog Talk Radio.
Eastern Standard Time, and that means it's time to express yourself. Your voice, your choice, with your host, Richard E. Ashby Jr. Listen in through littleflowerartist.com or marketingpulpit.com. It's time to express yourself. HALA is a North Carolina nonprofit organization that provides a variety of services, activities, and programs that aid in increasing children's test scores and also encourages the youth to make positive contributions to society. HALA was founded by Leon Gatewood. It has been the mission of Leon to ensure that HALA becomes a staple in the community by positively contributing to campaign for literacy in his community. HALA adopted the Little Flower Learning System as their program of choice for supporting community-wide literacy. For more information on HALA, visit www.hala.ws. That's www.holla.ws.
Good morning. This is Richard E. Ashby, Jr., and I'm the host of Express Yourself, Your Voice, Your Choice. I welcome you back to the radio show this morning, and my goodness, we have another fantastic show. This is our first show on this Thursday. We usually do once a month, the third Thursday, but we have expanded our show to the first and third Thursdays of the month, and we are going to be having a series going on here at Express Yourself. We have a wonderful guest this morning, Dr. Neil A. Lester. Dr. Lester is a foundational professor of English with specialties in African American literature and cultural studies. He's a professor at Arizona State University since 1997. He's an author and he's a co-author. And I'm telling you, last show we had our guest on was speaking about racist books back in the 30s and the 20s, and Dr. Lester is an expert on these books. He's also an expert on the N-word and the use of the N-word and the proliferation of the use of the N-word in our community, and we're going to have this conversation with him. This will be the first of a series of conversations that we will be having on Express Yourself, Your Voice, Your Choice. We will be talking to African-American librarians from across the country. We will be delving into the history of African-Americans in librarianship. And so this is just the beginning of a great series that we'll be doing here at Express Yourself, Your Voice, Your Choice. It gives me great pleasure to welcome my guest this morning, Dr. Neil A. Lester. Good morning, Dr. Lester.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine. First, let me just thank you for coming, and let me thank Cindy Landrum from the Evansville Public Library for hooking us up together, so to speak, and it's just
Absolutely.
A pleasure to have you on the show this morning.
Well, it is good to meet you and to be part of this conversation, and I, too, toss my hat out to Cindy for being that great connector that she is.
Yes. Dr. Lester, let's just get straight to this. Did you hear the show last week?
I was able to hear part of it. I had some technical difficulties, but I did hear your description of it and was happy to participate in a kind of follow-up to that conversation. So I know a little bit about it. I know the parameters, and I know that there's more to be said about the topic.
Well, just to start off with, can you give me your take on the topic and the history of those type of books? Where did it lead us? And where did it come from?
Well, I think the period that was mostly talked about was the 20s and 30s, which we know in this country was the time of Jim Crow. I also know that in the work that I do, what I've been able to do is to sort of move beyond that to see what brought us to Jim Crow. There were so many books, not just books, children's books, picture books, but also other children's texts that also sort of led us into those kinds of images that were both disparaging and dehumanizing. And what I mean by that is that we have to go back even farther to look at, say, the minstrel tradition of the 1800s and 1900s in order to see the ways in which children were embodied in some of those grotesque images that we now know as pickaninnies. So the books don't exist in a vacuum. They exist because there's so many other things in pop culture, whether they were nursery rhymes or picture books or toys, that sort of underscored this ways in which black children have been as dehumanized as black adults historically.
So you and I were talking off air earlier, and so to that point, we were talking about lawn jockeys.
Yes.
We were speaking about the Aunt Jemima image. Give me your take on that,
yes,
because those were things in the house that we seen daily that we didn't have to go to a book to see. Those are definite reminders.
Right. Well, I didn't personally. I grew up in the Deep South in Georgia. I personally did not see those in any household that I frequented, and they certainly weren't in mine. What was interesting and eye-opening for me is when I took my first job at the University of Alabama as an assistant professor back in the late 80s, is as I was looking at homes in quote-unquote professional neighborhoods. These were typically white neighborhoods, and that's where I would see a cookie jar or a lawn jockey. But these weren't in my neighborhoods, nor were they in the neighborhoods of people that I knew. So what I learned then is that there were people who still somehow had this sort of fetish for at least that period of our American history, a kind of romanticized way that many in the South still romanticize the Confederate flag. So children were not exempt from those images, and so it made sense that you would see, for example, not necessarily the N-word used in some of those books as they were, but you would see these really exaggerated images of not only children, but also of the parents. I'm thinking particularly, I know this was earlier, the 1899 Little Black Sambo. Little Black Sambo doesn't have the N-word in it, but it certainly has, you know, this sort of problematic narrative of a little black boy going into a jungle that's traditionally associated with exoticism, primitivism, all those things that we have come to associate with negative stereotypes and caricatures. But you also have these problematic names, Mumbo Jumbo and Sambo, and, you know, the sort of gluttony that's supposed to be humorous for children eating all these pancakes. And, of course, we can connect that with Aunt Jemima that's still on the pancake box today, even though she has a perm and has dropped her bandana. But we still got Uncle Ben who's, you know, smiling to serve up the cream of wheat. So for me, these images resonate not only in the present, but because they existed in the past. And you contrast that with the names of Mrs. Paul's, you know, fish sticks or Mrs. Butterworth. Even the naming suggests these sort of unequal sort of power dynamics.
You know, I grew up in New York on Long Island, and
mm-hmm.
lawn jockeys were prevalent in the communities.
Okay.
I didn't even know they were depictions of racism until my father told me. I was about 9 or 10, and he explained to me what the lawn jockey was, and he explained to me that they were always all black. I was living in a different world, you know, and he explained that to me.
And so many of those we didn't know. We didn't know to question these things, and you don't know what you don't know. And I say for so many and for so many years, Little Black Sambo, in many minds, was a trickster. Well, Little Black Sambo is a trickster because he allegedly tricks the tigers. However, my reading of that particular story suggests that he's lucky, that he's not a trickster. If he's a trickster, he would look more like Anansi the spider, or he would look like the signifying monkey. He does nothing that necessarily has him emerge as the victor, except the tigers get distracted. So I think in the absence of other books, we sort of grasped those images that were there and thought, well, I guess naively, you know, a representation, however grotesque it is better than no representation. And I'm glad we've evolved so that we don't have to sort of reduce ourselves to accepting these images because the other images are absent. So you're absolutely right. We have to learn that there's a problem with these. I did know, though, growing up in the South, though, when I didn't find myself, whether it was the day we had, you know, 60s Day, and I thought, well, what do I have to look for in the 60s in terms of media images? Happy Days didn't have it. The Brady Bunch didn't have it. So, you know, I fast forward and I say, if we had to look at those images, you know, of Friends and Seinfeld and all those super popular, you know, television stories which impacted our lives, we would find ourselves invisible.
And you know, we grew up with Amos and Andy.
Of course, yes. Yes. Well, and that would explain also why whenever there was a black person on television, many families would flock to the television if Nat King Cole was singing on Ed Sullivan or The Supremes, because there was this thirst to find representations that look like us. And I say that that's not any, you know, it's not different than what Maslow told us or tells us when he looks at that hierarchy of needs, is that we want to feel like we're present. You know, beyond the physical safety and, you know, having food, clothing, shelter, we want to feel like we belong. We want to feel like we are legitimized and that we can then self-actualize if we see ourselves present.
So then my question to you would be the N-word.
Uh-huh.
So is that why we use the N-word with each other? Or that's why not? Some people use the N-word to delegitimize all the things that we went through?
Well, I think that's a complicated question, and I guess the short of that is I think if we and I'm saying we as an Americans, but also we as an African American, sort of better understood our history, particularly as it relates to that word, then I think we would sort of see the naivete of trying to take back something that we never owned. These images of pickaninnies and in the UK, gollywogs were very black, bulging eyes, always smiling, exaggerated lips, the minstrel tradition that we see with Al Jolson. Those were not images that black people created for ourselves. Those were images that folks like T.D. Rice, when he came up with, Jump Jim Crow, created because he saw a slave and thought, let me imitate that. And let me imitate that. It's such that it becomes this huge entertainment for white audiences. So we can't take that back because we didn't give it to ourselves. The same is true of the N-word. If the N-word were something that we created for ourselves, and I say this because there's this extreme naivete that you can somehow change spellings and change the ugliness and the history of that word, and my contention is that we can't, that the history is much bigger than NWA. The history is much bigger than hip-hop, who thinks naively that you can take a word and change the ending of the word and have it mean something else. Well, if you look back at those minstrel songs that are now Disney tunes, whether it's, you know, Polly Wally Doodle or
Zippity-Doo-Dah,
Jim Crack Corn or Oh Susanna, they all have the N-word.
Coming around the mountain. Mm-hmm.
Or spell the way we think we've taken the spelling back. What hasn't changed, however, is the disparity that's used with people and how they're treated still around these issues of race. So when, you know, the example that Common uses in an ESPN documentary is that when the Birmingham bombing took place, those KKK members didn't call those folks by name saying, let's go bomb a church and we're going to hit, you know, Susie and Claudia. They said, let's go bomb this church because it's got a room full of N-words in it.
Yeah.
So I think if we can recognize that it's also how we are treated, but also the root of that word doesn't change. The N-I-G is still there. And I can tell you as one who has studied this, that in 2012, when President Obama was running for re-election, there was a very popular T-shirt and decal that said, 2012, don't re-NIG, and we knew exactly what that was. It didn't need the G-A, it didn't need the G-E-R, we knew exactly what that meant.
Mm.
So all of that is to say that if we don't know the history, and too many people want to package the history, put it on a shelf, tuck it way in the back, but the history lives in us, James Baldwin has said. We can't ignore the history. The history lives in us. The past is the present, Eugene O'Neill says. So this notion that we can separate the past from the present or somehow move on, I get a lot of that in various media interviews from other people who say, can't we just move on? I say, well, no, we can't move on until we know how we've gotten where we are. And that's where I think where the children's books, the children's texts, the toys, I mean, they're games, Little Black Sambo games. They're, you know, a rolling pin thing that I have in my office is rolling and knocking the little black boys down. The 10 little N-word boys and N-word girls teaches people how to count kids, how to count, but also how to subtract. But they're using the vehicle of violence. One little boy is stung to death. Another little boy is swallowed by a fish. Another little boy chops himself in half. So it's not just the word, but it's the narrative that is equally problematic when we're talking about representations or misrepresentations of a whole group of people. You can't take that back. What you can do is understand it and be informed by it so that you can then challenge those historical representations that still manifest in the present.
My goodness. Dr. Lester, you have said a mouthful. We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be right back with Respect Yourself, Your Voice, Your Choice. This is Richard Ashley with my guest, Dr. Lester, and we'll be right back after this message.
What a great show. Are you enjoying yourself? Great. Don't move a muscle. We'll be right back in just a few. You are tuned in to Express Yourself with host Richard E. Ashby Jr. on www.littleflowerartist.com and marketingpulpit.com. Marketing Pulpit International, also known as MPI, is committed to helping communities prosper by developing businesses, creating jobs, and building sustainable economic empowerment. MPI offers several radio shows throughout the week that touch on the issues that not only plague our communities, but also our country. For show schedules and more, visit www.marketingpulpit.com. That's www.marketingpulpit.com. We told you it wouldn't be long. We're back. Express Yourself, Your Voice, Your Choice with Richard E. Ashby Jr.
Welcome back. This is Richard E. Ashby, Jr., and my guest today is Dr. Neil A. Lester. Dr. Lester, thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you again for having me as your guest.
Now, Dr. Lester, you wrote a book, Their Eyes Are Watching God. You wrote a book about Your Eyes,
mm-hmm.
Your Eyes Are Watching God. Zora Neale Hurston actually wrote the book. The book is called
mm-hmm.
Understanding. Can you give me a quick synopsis about what is there to understand when you're reading this book?
It's a case book, and there's a whole series that this publisher has. So it's several books, and it's a supplement to the primary text. What drew me to writing about Their Eyes Are Watching God is that that's one of the texts that sort of allowed me to understand more about myself, but also more about our people. And I mean that in terms of the language, the richness of the language, the rich texture of black folks, particularly in the South, who had to create themselves despite the political, social, and historical disparities. So these were folks who created themselves through talking. And I mean everything from sitting on the porch gossiping to playing the dozens through those Yo Mama jokes and then through sermons. When they take the mule out. So what I was able to do in that book is to provide these original documents to help contextualize what Hurston is doing in that book that's unlike, you know, many other authors, who is sort of listening to people on the other side of the creek, listening to people who don't have PhDs, but listening to people who created themselves through telling stories and creating these elaborate rituals that we still hear and witness in barbershops. When you have black men talking to each other and they're one-upping and saying those Yo Mama jokes, that's the richness of a culture that we often relegate to insignificant because they're not studied, they're not scholarly. So what I try to do is to provide some original text, some of those idioms. My mother used to say, as a little black woman in the South, I'm a little piece of leather, but I'm well put together. Now, I don't know if she made that up, but it's something I remember because it's like poetry. It's
mm-hmm.
what I see when I go to my historic Tanner Chapel Church in in Phoenix, Arizona, and I watched the pastor create these kinds of word images and these word stories, you know, that bring the Bible stories alive.
Yes.
That's a power that we don't always celebrate, and that's what I try to talk about in the casebook. I give you a bunch of some interviews of people who actually lived through Jim Crow, so this is not necessarily famous people. There's a story in there where a man tells me about a lynching in Birmingham, Alabama. So these are real stories, and they're ways to contextualize, which I think is a fabulous, fabulous novel about black people talking. And if you historically know black people haven't been able to talk, whether it was silence through the physicality of American slavery or later Jim Crow, the fight for the civil rights, you know what it's like to be silenced and to somehow command power in a way that connected you to a community of people who was also silenced.
You know, you mentioned the barbershop conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I remember as a kid going to the barbershop, I would love to hear the men speak,
yeah.
Tell their stories, play the dungeons,
yeah.
Recite Rudy Ray Moore, do the
yeah.
Signifying monkey.
Absolutely. And we miss some of that. I mean, you know, first of all, when you went to a barbershop, even a beauty shop, there was something more than going to a beauty shop and a barbershop just to get your hair done. It was about engaging in a kind of community, a kind of fellowship. And what I'm pleased to see is that ritual continues. People may not be telling the same stories, but they're telling stories. I hear music in there. You know, those barbershop movies that we had a few years ago
mm-hmm.
were right on target when they talked about, you know, the person who owned the barbershop also owned the liquor store next door. So he would leave me sometimes in the chair to go over to give somebody, not give, but to sell somebody X, Y, and Z. And people would bring stuff to the barbershop to pawn. So I remember I was waiting sometimes to get in the barber's seat for my then flat top fade like Arsenio Hall. You know, I would be shopping in the back to see what people had brought into pawns. I remember buying a train set there and buying a pair of shoes there. So it was like one-stop shopping when you went to get your barbershop, your haircut.
That's so true. Even today, to this day, when I go to the barbershop, the barbers know I'm coming in with a story. I'm talking from the moment I get in there, I'm telling a story.
Right. Well, I never participated in the storytelling, but I certainly benefited from the story hearing.
Uh-huh.
And I was so excited to be in that environment. And, you know, I've since gone to other environments where you go into a Fantastic Sam's or a Great Clips. It is not the same. And beauty shops are like that because I now have locks. And so rather than going to a barbershop, I go to a barbershop that also has a salon. And the same thing's happening with the women in there.
Mm-hmm.
They have got political conversations going on. They have got pop culture conversations going on. These are about critical conversations. And one of the things that I hope that I will be able to do with my initiative called Project Humanities at ASU is start going into barbershops. Because we go into restaurants and churches and other places to have our programming, but we have yet to go into a barbershop. And part of that is because they're open all the time.
Okay.
You can have a barbershop that's open on Sunday afternoons now.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because one of the things that I'm doing here in Philadelphia is I'm going to be starting to do book readings and author signings in the beauty parlors and barbershops.
Absolutely.
Because
go
that's
where
people
are.
That's where the
go
people
where the
are.
People are.
Now, Dr. Lester, we have a couple of minutes left here, and I want to give you the opportunity. I'm asking one more question, and then I want to give you the opportunity to tell about some of the upcoming things you're doing. You have, I see, Once Upon a Time in a Different World, Issues and Ideas in African-American Children's Literature. Can you tell me what that's about?
Yeah, that is a collection of my essays. Rather than going to all these different journals trying to find it, I put them together. And not just putting all the essays together, but I also have invited some scholars and non-scholars to sort of do a kind of call and response. So I've written an essay about, the ways in which we glorify alphabet literacy, sometimes at the expense of that sort of orality and the ways in which storytelling can be just as powerful. So I have somebody else commenting on that particular essay. There's also a section where my then teen daughter and I read the same young adult book, and we wrote our separate reviews, and then we sort of see where our perspectives intersect and where they differ. And we try to assess the extent to which my perspectives are influenced by her as my daughter and her perspectives influenced by me as the father. So it's an interesting kind of strategy, I think, and it's a range of things from children's books about hair to the N-word to this notion of literacy, and also heteronormativity, the ways in which, you know, we still have books, but they're still about fathers and mothers and not necessarily other combinations of a family. But in terms of that book is accessible to both educators, librarians, and it feels like it's a wonderful way of looking at a range of topics that deal with both adult literature and the intersections with children's texts. But coming up, we have some workshops on privilege and bias. This is where I think we have sort of fallen short in conversations about diversity. You know, sometimes when we're talking about children's texts, we're not talking about blatant racism. We're talking about bias, the ways in which certain families have been presented or depicted unfairly. So that's what I'll say is look for ways that I am going around the country presenting workshops for business folks. Would love to do something like this at one of your conferences so that we are looking at bias, not just in what other people are bringing to the table, but what are we bringing to the table? What baggage do we have that we're not even aware of? And also looking at these issues of diversity in intersectional ways. So it's hard to talk about something just being about race because nothing is just about race. It's race and. Talking about Ferguson, Missouri, it's race and class. It's race and gender. It's race and all these things.
So when people just try to limit the conversation to race,
uh-huh.
They're really trying to put it in a box, and it's not able really to fit this in a box. It's
exactly.
Bigger than a box.
Exactly. Well, because
the
people
box
are not boxes.
And the wrapping.
That's right. People are not boxes. In fact, Toni Morrison said, in the bluest eye, let's put the label out of business. You know, whenever you know, it's convenient to label things. You know, this is a boy, this is a girl, this is black, this is white. But people aren't labels, and sometimes the label doesn't fit what's inside what you get. So if we can sort of talk about this intersectionally, it can show that we are all members of multiple communities at one time. We are members of an aged community, we're a member of a race community, we're a member of a gendered community, or communities that have sexual identities. We are, you know, either in the thin group or the not thin group. There are ways in which we have mental illness or we are able-bodied. All of these things happen in one person. So, you know, I think it was Angela Davis who said something about one of the things we need to acknowledge as black folks is that we are members of multiple communities simultaneously. And sometimes people feel like they have to forfeit one community in order to advance another. So during the Civil Rights Movement, for example, blackness was all that mattered, and that blackness usually manifested itself in male representation. In the feminist movement, black women had to forget about their race in order to position their gender. And into Zaki Shange, who wrote for Colored Girl, said, well, I'm these things at the same time. I have black skin and I have female body parts at the same time. I can't choose those. And I think that's where my work is going, is trying to help people better understand that this is not so much about other people, but what are we bringing to the table? What are our own biases? And we all have them. They're neither good nor bad. They just are.
Well, Dr. Lester, on that note, I want to thank you for being my guest today. I'm looking forward to hearing you and speaking with you. I'm looking forward to reading more about your work and what you're doing. So once again, thank you so very much for agreeing to be my guest today on Respect Yourself, Express Yourself, Your Voice, Your Choice.
Well, thank you so much for welcoming me and being such a hospitable and enthusiastic host. So blessings to you, and thank you again.
Thank you. This is Richard E. Ashby, Jr. for Express Yourself, Your Voice, Your Choice. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you for tuning in to Express Yourself, Your Voice, Your Choice, with host Richard E. Ashby, Jr. Make sure to tune in every third Thursday at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to www.littleflowerartist.com and marketingpulpit.com. Express Yourself, Your Voice, Your Choice. We'll see you again real soon.